Watching C-SPAN's America and the Courts. Next, the Supreme Court Historical Society's annual meeting. The Supreme Court Historical Society is a 23-year-old private nonprofit organization. The group says it's dedicated to the collection and preservation of the history of the Supreme Court. In addition to publishing historical articles on the court and sponsoring various lecture series, the Society runs the gift shop in the Supreme Court building. Justice Thomas provides the keynote address at the Historical Society's annual meeting. His lecture on the Supreme Court case Plessy v. Ferguson lasts 45 minutes and follows these introductions.
Good afternoon. My name is Brad Reynolds, and I'm the chair of the Supreme Court Historical Society's annual meeting. And I welcome you all today to the Supreme Court, and to this, the 22nd of the Society's annual lectures. I'd like to now turn the podium over to the Historical Society's president, Leon Silverman, who will introduce our speaker this afternoon. Thank you.
Good evening or good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Before I introduce our guest speaker, note that Justices Ginsburg and Breyer are with us, and we are honored by their presence. Now, on behalf of the officers and trustees of the Supreme Court Historical Society, I welcome each of you to our 22nd annual lecture. This being the first event in today's busy schedule, I must first call the Society's annual meeting to order, and to note that we are delighted to have as our speaker today Associate Justice Clarence Thomas. We are honored and privileged that he joins us this afternoon to deliver the Society's 1997 lecture. You may know that Justice Thomas was born in the thriving metropolis of Pinpoint, Georgia, in 1948. Following high school, he attended the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and in 1971, he was admitted to the Yale Law School. Following law school, Justice Thomas went to work for John C. Danforth, then the Attorney General for the state of Missouri, subsequently a United States Senator, and 2.5 years later, he joined Senator Danforth's staff in Washington as his legislative assistant. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan appointed him Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Department of Education. He was subsequently elevated to become chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where he served for nearly 8 years. In 1990, Justice Thomas was appointed by President George Bush to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and the following year, in 1991, President Bush appointed him to the Supreme Court of the United States to succeed Justice Thurgood Marshall. He has now provided the country with 6 years of distinguished service on the bench, and as I say, we are honored to have with us this afternoon Justice Clarence Thomas. His subject will be Plessy versus Ferguson Revisited. I present to you Justice Clarence Thomas.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Leon, and I'd like to thank my colleagues, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, for being here. They're the two I see. I know it's a busy day. Today is the final day we have for submitting our majority opinions. And we normally don't leave things for the last minute around here. So, well, at least there's one among us who doesn't. Certainly not me. But I would like to especially thank them for taking time from a very frenetic day to be here. I hope in the end it's worth the sacrifice. Again, I thank each of you for being here. It's quite a rainy day outside. I was telling Leon earlier that if I had nothing to do, I don't think I'd do it coming through the rain. But with that said, I would like to, for just one brief moment, to acknowledge my friend Dorothy Goldman, who is the widow of Howard Goldman. It's a dear, dear friend who passed away a short while ago. As we near the end of this century, I would like to discuss a decision that came at the close of the last century, Plessy versus Ferguson, the notorious 1896 case that helped usher in, or at least sanction, more than half a century of legalized racism. In particular, I would like to discuss it from the standpoint of those who were on the losing side and the virtues of losing, especially in the face of insurmountable odds. I must say in passing that, as virtuous as it may be, losing is not an experience to which I hope to become that accustomed to on this court, although we all must swallow the bitter pill from time to time. The 100th anniversary of Plessy has passed with almost the same lack of general interest that the decision received when Justice Henry Billings Brown delivered the opinion for a 7-1 court on May 18, 1896. As the historian C. Van Woodward describes it, in contrast to the great controversy that arose when the court struck down much of the 1875 Civil Rights Act in the civil rights cases, the Plessy decision was accorded only short, inconspicuous news coverage and virtually no editorial comment outside the Negro press. Reviewing the newspapers of the day, one writer of today observes that several papers ignored Plessy in favor of decisions involving an heiress's million-dollar inheritance and a claim of plagiarism by a well-known playwright. Progressive journals such as the Harvard Law Review and the Yale Law Journal busied themselves with articles such as The Law of Icy Sidewalks in New York State and 2 years' experience of the New York State Board of Law Examiners, but paid no attention to Plessy. Aside from a sprinkling of law review articles and law school addresses, Plessy's centenary also has passed with little attention. This may be the case, at least in part, because of the excellent scholarly work on Plessy done by Professor Charles Lofgren and by Professor Owen Fisk. Such work may have discouraged others from entering the field. Plessy, however, may be receiving such disinterest today because of its complete rejection by our society. If so, the recent apathy toward Plessy is a striking demonstration of the benefits of losing. For it was in losing in Plessy that the foundations were laid for the eventual victory over segregation. To explore this idea, I would like to examine the stories of three people who lost in 1896. The defendant, Homer Plessy, his lawyer, Albion Tourget, and John Marshall Harlan, the lone dissenter in Plessy. More is known of the case that bears his name than is known of Homer Plessy, the man who challenged Louisiana's Separate Car Act. Passed in 1890, by the Louisiana legislature, the act required equal but separate accommodations for blacks and whites on railroad cars. Railroad employees, such as conductors, were responsible for assigning passengers to the cars on the basis of their race, and railroads could refuse to carry anyone without liability for damages who did not comply with the assignment. Employees faced a maximum $25 fine and up to 20 days in jail if they made incorrect assignments, as did passengers who insisted on sitting in the wrong seat. Nurses attending children of another race were exempted, and I leave it only to you to guess nurses of which race and children of which race. A committee of New Orleans blacks decided to seek a test case to challenge this law and retained Albion Tourget, a Republican lawyer then living in New York, to handle the litigation. Though I focused on Tourget, virtually all of the local work was done by his able co-counsel, James C. Walker, a New Orleans attorney. Homer Plessy, however, was not the first plaintiff chosen to bring suit. In late 1891, Tourget and Louis Martinet, a New Orleans lawyer, physician, and newspaper founder, began to search for an ideal case. They entered into discussions with the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, which agreed to the test. Their first client was Daniel F. Desdunais, a 21-year-old octoroon. In other words, one who was only 1/8 black and was of such fair complexion that he might pass for white. He was the son of Rodolph Desdunais, one of the leaders of the Creole community in New Orleans. Desdunais was arrested for sitting in a whites-only car on a trip from New Orleans to Mobile, Alabama. Desdunais's case, however, was dismissed because the Louisiana Supreme Court held, in the meantime, that the Louisiana Act did not apply to interstate railway trips. Plessy, a 34-year-old octoroon friend of Desdunais, became the next plaintiff. He purchased a ticket in June 1892 for a trip from New Orleans to Covington, Louisiana, a wholly intrastate trip on the East Carolina Railroad. He was arrested after he attempted to sit in the white car. It seems clear that the incident had been prearranged with the railroad, because although Plessy was a passenger of the colored race, he was but 1/8 black, and according to his counsel, the mixture of colored blood was not discernible. In fact, the criminal information against Plessy did not mention his race at all, nor was his race discussed during the trial proceedings. The Louisiana Supreme Court would use this lack of color against Plessy. In its opinion, affirming the constitutionality of the Louisiana Separate Car Act, the court observed that, and I quote, "The statute applies to the two races with such perfect fairness and equality that the record brought up for our inspection does not disclose whether the person prosecuted is a white or a colored man." Plessy's appearance became an important issue in the case. It formed the basis of an alternative argument in case the appellate courts rejected Plessy's core 14th Amendment claim of equal justice before the law. Before both the Louisiana and United States Supreme Courts, Plessy argued that the Louisiana law was irrational and arbitrary for classifying an octoroon as black, though the mixture of colored blood was not discernible, and that he was actually white and entitled to the full privileges and immunities secured to citizens of the United States of the white race by the Constitution and laws of the United States. Plessy's first claim in his brief before the Supreme Court went so far as to argue that his whiteness was a constitutionally protected property right and that authorizing railroad employees to deny it violated the Due Process Clause. Although this argument might have appealed to the property-conscious Supreme Court of the late 19th century, today it seems to ring strange. As a historian, C. Van Woodward has observed, this was not the defense of the colored man against discrimination by whites, but a defense of the nearly white man against the penalties of color. Plessy was tried before Judge John H. Ferguson, who ultimately would become the named defendant in Louisiana Criminal District Court on October 13, 1892. Plessy challenged the jurisdiction of the court, as one did under the procedures of the day, by pleading that the Louisiana law was unconstitutional for requiring racial separation in violation of the 13th and 14th Amendments. His lawyers claimed that the law imposed a badge of servitude on their client by perpetuating the distinction of race and caste among citizens of the United States. As their brief declared, the statute in question establishes an insidious distinction and discrimination between citizens of the United States based on race, which is obnoxious to the fundamental principles of national citizenship, perpetuates involuntary servitude as regards to citizens of the colored race under the merest pretense of promoting the comforts of passengers on railway trains and in further respects abridges the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States and the rights secured by the 13th and 14th Amendments of the Federal Constitution. In addition to his alternative arguments about the arbitrary classification of octoroons, Tourget also claimed that the exception for nurses was irrational and that the delegation of authority to railroad employees was illegal. After losing his motion before Judge Ferguson, Plessy took an immediate appeal to the Louisiana Supreme Court. Narrowing the statute by interpretation in certain ways, that court rejected Plessy's claims, asserting that an almost uniform course of decision among the lower federal courts and the state courts permitted separate but equal facilities. Louisiana Justice Charles Fenner announced that equality and not identity or community of accommodations is the extreme test of conformity to the requirements of the 14th Amendment. As the United States Supreme Court would agree 3 years later, the Louisiana justices concluded that the law constituted a valid exercise of the state police power in the interests of public order, peace, and comfort. Plessy took an immediate appeal to the United States Supreme Court. He continued to raise his challenge to the Louisiana law as a badge of inferiority in violation of the 13th Amendment and as a denial of equal treatment by the laws on the basis of his race in violation of the 14th Amendment. Justice Brown, writing for a 7-1 court, rejected these arguments on the ground that separation did not mean inequality on the basis of race in violation of the 14th Amendment. The object of the amendment was undoubtedly to enforce the absolute equality of the two races before the law. But in the nature of things, it could not have been intended to abolish distinctions based upon color or to enforce social as distinguished from political equality or a commingling of the two races upon terms unsatisfactory to either, so Justice Brown reasoned. The court dismissively rejected Plessy's claim that even if the facilities were equal, the separation itself placed blacks in an inferior state in violation of the 14th Amendment. Quoting Justice Brown's opinion again, we consider the underlying fallacy of the plaintiff's argument to consist in the assumption that the enforced separation of the two races stamps the colored race with a badge of inferiority. If this be so, it is not by reason of anything found in the act, but solely because the colored race chooses to put that construction upon it. As Professor Charles Black, Jr., who taught at Yale Law School during my years there, described this part of the court's opinion, and I quote, the curves of callousness and stupidity intersect at their respective maxima. Once the Supreme Court issued its decision, the criminal proceedings against Plessy could resume. Accordingly, on January 11, 1897, more than 4 years after he had attempted to board a white railroad car, Plessy entered a guilty plea in criminal district court. He was fined $25. Homer Plessy died 28 years later in 1925 at the age of 63, and he was buried in St. Louis Cemetery No. 1 in New Orleans, Louisiana. All else, however, about the intervening years of his life appears to be lost to history. Homer Plessy's lawyer, from the criminal district court all the way to the United States Supreme Court, as alluded to earlier, was Albion Tourget. As I also alluded earlier, however, James C. Walker of New Orleans was a local counsel who actually drafted all pleadings and seems to have masterminded the strategy for the case. Tourget has already lived and had already lived an interesting life as a soldier in the Union Army during the Civil War, as a carpetbagger, as a popular novelist, and as a lifelong advocate of equal justice for blacks. Tourget's sympathetic biographer, Otto Olson, for example, entitled his work, Carpetbagger's Crusade. By the time of Plessy, Tourget had become, in Olson's words, the nation's most persistent and vociferous white champion of full racial equality. Tourget welcomed an aggressive approach to challenging Jim Crow in Louisiana. Submission to such outrages, he advised the New Orleans blacks, tends only to their multiplication and exaggeration. It is by constant resistance to oppression that the race must ultimately win equality of right. While Tourget did not live to see that day, his was one of many steps on the road to equal rights regardless of race. Tourget grew up in Ohio and Massachusetts in centers of abolitionism. He attended the University of Rochester in 1859, dropped out for financial reasons, returned, and then enlisted as a private in the Union Army when the war came. As a member of the 27th New York Volunteer Infantry, Tourget fought at the First Battle of Bull Run and was injured when a retreating battery ran him down. Paralyzed and beset by the back problems that would plague him the rest of his life, Tourget eventually recovered enough to re-enlist, this time as a lieutenant in the 105th Ohio Volunteer Infantry. Wounded again in operations in Tennessee and Kentucky, Tourget was captured, imprisoned, and then exchanged. Returning briefly from the front in 1863 to get married in Ohio, he rejoined the 105th Ohio, but his injured back forced his resignation in December 1863. Tourget then began his career as a lawyer and politician. Returning to Ohio, Tourget resumed his legal studies and gained admission to the Ohio Bar in 1864. In 1865, attracted by opportunity in the South and driven to warmer climes by his declining health, Tourget moved to Greensboro, North Carolina. He edited a newspaper and then in 1868 became a delegate to the North Carolina Constitutional Convention, which had been called to draft a new constitution so that the state could gain readmittance to the Union. After the convention, Tourget was appointed to a state commission charged with drafting a new code of civil procedure. And then in 1868, he was elected a superior court judge. As a judge, Tourget sought to impose tough justice on the Ku Klux Klan, despite threats to his personal safety. As Republicans began to lose their hold on power, Tourget's possibilities for re-election evaporated, and he left the bench in 1874. He was sent again as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention of 1875, lost the race for Congress in 1878, and left the state in 1879. Eventually settling in upstate New York, Tourget became a writer and achieved fame with a novel based on his experiences in the South. The book, entitled A Fool's Errand, was a remarkable success and sold 200,000 copies. A large figure for that time, and I might add for this time also. It blamed both the stubborn racism among some elements in the South and the cowardice of the North for the failure of Reconstruction. Continuing to write, Tourjet worked on various equal rights enterprises and took on the Plessy case pro bono. Tourjet knew that he faced long odds before the court. As he said, even before Plessy had reached oral argument, the court has always been the foe of liberty until forced to move on by public opinion. In the preceding quarter century, the Supreme Court had invalidated the Civil Rights Act of 1875, had narrowed the scope of the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause, had invalidated the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, and had enforced a state action requirement on civil rights bills passed pursuant to the 14th Amendment. Lower federal and state courts had permitted separate but equal facilities, while judicial decisions in non-racial 14th Amendment cases generally permitted a wide discretion to courts, to states, in exercise of their police powers. The times also seemed to be moving against Tourjet, as the compromise of 1877 had been followed by the reenactment of segregation laws in several southern states and the disappearance of the Republican Party in the South. Indeed, the years after Plessy would witness the almost complete disenfranchisement of blacks by practices and procedures, barring them access to the polls and the extension of Jim Crow to almost every aspect of life. Nevertheless, Tourjet and the co-counsel he acquired for the Supreme Court litigation, Samuel Phillips, a former Solicitor General who had argued the civil rights cases, went forward with the appeal before the court. Why, one might ask? To be sure, Tourjet, like every good counsel, had counted the votes and thought he could find a way to win. In an October 1893 letter to Louis Martinet, as I noted, one of the New Orleans Creole leaders who had organized opposition to the Louisiana law, Tourjet began to express some doubts about whether to seek an expedited hearing for the case or to wait. He admitted that of the whole number of justices, there is but one who's known to favor the view we must stand upon, and that there are five who are against us. Of these, one may be reached, I think, if he hears from the country soon enough. The others will probably stay where they are until Gabriel blows his horn. In order that this fifth justice hear the country, Tourjet recommended that measures be taken to sway public opinion and the news media against segregation as soon as possible, and that the case not be rushed. Tourjet held up his end of the bargain. It would take more than 3 years for the court to hear argument and render a decision after the Louisiana court had issued its judgment. But the expression of public opinion he sought never emerged. Litigation tactics aside, there was more to Tourjet's effort to pursue this case in the face of, it must be admitted, daunting odds. Tourjet had never given up his crusading efforts to defeat racism, and in his letter to Martinet, he made clear his feelings that Plessy was part of a larger fight. And I quote, "The American Negro will have to make his contest for equality of right and opportunity with the Negro-hating white man of the United States, wherever he may be upon the planet. There is but one way. The battle of liberty, justice, and equal opportunity must be fought out here. The colored man and those white men who believe in liberty and justice, who do not think Christ's teaching a sham, must join hands and hearts and win with brain and patience and wisdom and courage." Some might question Tourjet's decision to proceed, but he was a man who believed in fighting for his principles. Of course, as we all know, Tourjet did lose, and it is almost certain that even if he had never brought his case to the Supreme Court, some other case would have presented the court with the opportunity to affirm the doctrine of separate but equal. His efforts, however, were not in vain. His forceful and direct challenge of segregation was a violation of the 13th and 14th Amendments, forced the court to display openly the racial attitudes that underlay its decision. The obviousness and moral wrongness of these attitudes would stand as a symbol of injustice that would defile our jurisprudence, tear at the seams of our nation, but to unify blacks. Further, Tourjay's argument may have inspired Justice Harlan's dissent in Plessy. In his brief, for example, Tourjay wrote that, and I quote, "Instead of being intended to promote the general comfort and moral well-being, this act is plainly and evidently intended to promote the happiness of one class by asserting its supremacy and the inferiority of another class. Justice is pictured blind, and her daughter, the law, ought to at least be colorblind." Tourjay's brief also would have an impact further into the future. While considering another segregation case more than 50 years later, Justice Robert Jackson took an interest in Tourjay, who had lived, as I noted, in upstate New York, near the justice's home. He wrote to two friends of his discovery of Tourjay. "The Plessy case arose in Louisiana, and how Tourjay got into it, I have not learned. In any event, I have gone to his old brief filed here, and there is no argument made today that he would not make to the court. He says, justice is pictured blind, and her daughter, the law, ought at least to be colorblind. Whether this was original with him, it has been gotten off a number of times since as original wit." Tourjay's brief was filed April 6, 1896, and now, just 54 years after, the question is again being argued whether his position will be adopted and what was a defeat for him in 96 be a post-mortem victory. We can only speculate whether Jackson's discovery of Tourjay's brief influenced his thinking in Brown v. Board of Education. We can be sure, however, that the position he adopted in 1896 did become the grounds for, as Justice Jackson's put it, a post-mortem victory. As I noted earlier, and as we all have known for about as long as we could read, in 1896, Tourjay lost, and he lost convincingly. As Charles Lofgren has written, however, Plessy is more than a tale of losers. Besides having their years in court, Martinet and Tourjay had their arguments displayed on the record, indeed memorialized in Justice Harlan's dissent to instruct later generations. Among those later generations would be the blacks and their brave lawyers who challenged the evils of segregation. Tourjay's work, even in a losing effort, forced the court to articulate and endorse the principle of separate but equal, that as a symbol of racism and injustice would inspire those who fought against it. In losing to evil, Tourjay laid the foundations for its eventual defeat. The third figure in this story is the justice who immortalized the efforts of Plessy and Tourjay in the United States reports, Justice John Marshall Harlan. Harlan had grown up in Kentucky, studied law at Transylvania University, joined the state bar in 1853, and practiced law with his father, who was a close friend of Henry Clay and a leading politician in the state. He was elected a county judge in 1858, and when the war came, he joined the Union Army as a lieutenant colonel at the head of the 10th Kentucky Volunteer Infantry. He participated in battles in Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Coincidentally, he and Tourjay may have been involved in the same pursuit of the elusive cavalry of Confederate General John Morgan in Kentucky and Tennessee. Upon his father's death in 1863, Harlan resigned his commission, returned home, and emerged as a leader of the Constitutional Unionist Party. He was elected state attorney general, and when the war ended, he switched to the Republican Party. He also lost two tries for the governorship. As head of the Kentucky delegation to the Republican National Convention in 1876, Harlan's switch of support to Rutherford B. Hayes gave the latter the presidential nomination. Hayes placed Harlan on a commission to choose which of two rival Louisiana governments was legitimate. Then, in a show of reconciliation to the South, President Hayes tapped Harlan to fill a court vacancy. At first glance, Harlan would not have struck observers as a natural defender of equal rights for blacks. As his most recent biographer has pointed out, Harlan had joined the Know-Nothing movement in the 1850s and had been a slave owner. During his political campaigns in Kentucky, Harlan had vehemently opposed emancipation, extension of the vote to former slaves, and federal programs to help freed slaves. As the Attorney General of Kentucky, he had attempted to prevent the spread of abolitionist policies. We must note that Kentucky was not covered by the Emancipation Proclamation because it had remained in the Union. As a result, opposing these tendencies was important. After the war, he had publicly supported segregated schools and had opposed the public accommodations provisions of the 1875 Civil Rights Act. He apparently told racist jokes during a campaign speech and continued to do so privately once on the bench. He had a mulatto half-brother, Robert Harlan, the son of his father and a slave, with whom he kept in contact, but whom he never formally acknowledged as a member of the family. Despite these racial attitudes, Justice Harlan took up the cause of equal rights on the court. He dissented in the civil rights cases, intentionally using the very pen and inkwell used by Chief Justice Roger B. Taney to write Dred Scott. Harlan declared that, and I quote, constitutional provisions adopted in the interest of liberty and for the purpose of securing through national legislation, if need be, rights inhering in the state of freedom and belonging to American citizenship have been so construed as to defeat the ends of the people desired to accomplish, which they attempted to accomplish, and which they supposed they had accomplished by changes in their fundamental law. In Hurtado versus California, Justice Harlan again dissented and argued that the framers of the 14th Amendment had intended to incorporate the Bill of Rights against the states. These decisions were followed by Justice Harlan's justly famous dissent in Plessy. As he did in the civil rights cases, Justice Harlan dissented alone in arguing that the 14th Amendment prohibited the state from making distinctions among its citizens on the basis of race. He wrote, and I quote, in view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. There is no caste here. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. He quickly dismissed the argument that separate but equal treated both races justly. Everyone knows, he said, that the statute in question had its origin in the purpose, not so much to exclude white persons from railroad cars occupied by blacks, as to exclude colored people from coaches occupied by or assigned to white persons. He realized that he was writing for the ages, if not for the country. In my opinion, he declared, the judgment this day rendered will in time prove to be quite as pernicious as a decision made by this tribunal in the Dred Scott case. These courageous words, written in defiance of his unified brethren and of the history of his times, won Justice Harlan a low opinion in the eyes of some of his then and future colleagues. The other great dissenter, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, described Justice Harlan as, and I quote, the last of the tobacco-spitting judges, and described his mind as a great vice, the two jaws of which could never be closed. Justice Felix Frankfurter, in his concurrence in Adamson versus California, described Justice Harlan's views on incorporation as that of an eccentric. No doubt, some of these views concerning Justice Harlan's character arose from the moral certainty with which he adhered to his principles, a certainty which sometimes bursts forth in his physical conduct. It is said, for example, that while reading his dissent in the income tax case, Justice Harlan pounded the bench for emphasis and wagged his finger in the face of Chief Justice Fuller and Justice Field. Chief Justice Hughes told the story that Justice Bradley, the author of the majority opinion in the civil rights cases, and Justice Harlan actually shook fists at each other, or at one another. In remarks at a dinner given by the Supreme Court Bar in honor of Justice Harlan's 25th anniversary on the court, Justice David Brewer observed, perhaps jokingly, that his colleague, quote, goes to bed every night with one hand on the Constitution and the other hand on the Bible, and so sleeps the sweet sleep of justice and righteousness. While his certainty and fervor may have rubbed his contemporaries the wrong way, it was his belief in his principles that perhaps allowed him to endure the solitary position in which he often found himself. It was his firm belief in the righteousness of his cause that allowed his words to speak to future generations. It was his attachment to principle that guaranteed that his positions one day would inspire others to defeat that great wrong he had fought against in a losing struggle. His ringing declaration that our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens is one of the most famous and powerful phrases in American constitutional law. Harlan's words were a beacon to blacks as they lived under oppression and fought to overturn dreadful laws of segregation. I can remember as a young child growing up under segregation, learning the phrase, our Constitution is colorblind, before I even knew what the Supreme Court was or who Justice Harlan was. His words inspired the great civil rights revolution that removed the black codes and Jim Crow. As Judge Constance Baker Motley reminisced during a ceremony in this very court to honor Justice Thurgood Marshall, Justice Harlan's dissent was a steady resource to Justice Marshall during his time as chief counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. As she said, Marshall had a Bible to which he turned during his most depressed moments. Marshall would read aloud passages from Harlan's amazing dissent. I do not believe we ever filed a major brief in the pre-Brown days in which a portion of that opinion was not quoted. Marshall's favorite quotation was, our Constitution is colorblind. It became our basic creed. Marshall admired the courage of Harlan more than any justice who has ever sat on the Supreme Court. Every Chief Justice, even Chief Justice Earl Warren's forthright and moving decision for the court in Brown did not affect Marshall in the same way. Earl Warren, who was writing for a unanimous court, Harlan was a solitary and lonely figure writing for posterity. While Justice Harlan, Albion Tourget, and Homer Plessy may have lost their case, they placed the nation and this court on the proper course to vindicate the great principle of equal justice before the law. Their example and their words inspired others to continue their struggle, to fight their fight, to endure hardships and setbacks. Though their story was not the story of winners, they sparked a long and hard struggle, one that would not end until they were long dead. Indeed, their victory must, of necessity, be post-mortem. Thank you all.
Thank you, Justice Thomas, for your most informative